Welcome to Resounds, Arts and Culture on the High Plains. I'm Corby Skinner.
And I'm Anna Page. And we're sharing stories of creative people who live and work in the Intermountain West. Montana is a pretty good muse, and with all this rugged, vast beauty, poetry seems to flow better in Big Sky Country.
April is National Poetry Month, and we've had the honor of talking with the Montana Poet Laureates, Tammy Holland and Michael Earl Craig. Both are contemporary poets with quite different backgrounds.
Tammy chairs the Department of English, Philosophy, and Modern Languages at MSUB and teaches English and creative writing. Earl is a farrier, traveling from his home in Livingston all around the state, shoeing horses.
I recently had the opportunity to speak to both poets and talk about their creative process and hear some of their poetry. I am honored to have two of Montana's most well-known contemporary poets in the studio with me today, Tammy Holland and Earl Craig. And both Tammy and Earl have the distinct honor of having been the Montana Poet Laureate. And I think, Earl, you are the current Poet Laureate.
Yep. So that's right.
Let's start with that. The funny thing about the Poet Laureate position, because I have been familiar with it, it's an honor with no pay. Is that correct? It's sort of designated by the Arts Center, but other than being deemed the Poet Laureate, it doesn't come with any awards.
Yeah, Tammy and I are still waiting for the envelope.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. It'll be here someday. No, Humanities Montana stepped in, though, and has made it really possible for the Poet Laureate to travel around the state. They put us on their, you know, their Speakers Bureau. The Montana Conversations Program, and that has made it possible because there are so many miles in this state.
Communities can call Humanities Montana and request to have the Poet Laureate come out and do a workshop or reading.
Yeah.
Is that correct?
Yeah, that's a there has to be a 30 or maybe a 60-day lead time, and then they just let them know what the program's going to be, how many days or hours, and then so they cover mileage, meals, motels, things like that. It's really good.
We have an anthology coming out, and we'll talk a little bit more about that, Poems Across the Big Sky, which is a collection Lowell Yeager put together of poets across Montana. And I was wondering when I was looking through this and reading it, is there a particular Montana voice that comes out in poetry, or do you sense that in any way? Tammy, do you want to take that?
Well, I hope it's diverse. I hope we have many voices. You know, I think it would be a shame if there were just a single voice. And in reading through it, I have just been impressed with all of the, you know, the people who, for the first time ever, have been published in this volume. And they write about, you know, people write about their lives. Earl writes about an antique photograph of a bear, for example, and you know, people are writing about all kinds of topics, and I think their voices are diverse.
Mm-hmm. Earl?
Yeah, I was impressed also with the range. I figured that maybe they would be landscape driven, and a lot of the work is, but they're just such a pretty wonderful range of work in here. It's impressive. And this is the second one he's done, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. There was one in, I think, 2007.
Since we have the book in front of us, I am going to have both of you give a little sample of the poetry that you have. I think both of you have a couple poems in the book.
Yeah.
Tammy, do you have a particular favorite you'd like to read for us?
I'll read this one. It's called Song for the Solstice. In December, she eats the last tomato from her garden and puts the year to bed over pasta and Reggiano, its worst sorrows and hours blended into a moment. The tomato is acidic, bright, not like the vine-ripened and fuller fruit harvested in sun. Each year, she saves some, watches them mature or shrivel. small meal at a wooden table, the dog restless, small celebration of last fruits, the aunt dying in her 93rd year, the mother already gone. In honor of teacups and saucers, the fine inherited glass and linen come to order her life. A toast to the darkest day, to light finding the rooms.
Tammy, you grew up in northeast Montana, is that correct?
North central, really, the High Line, mm-hmm. a little town called Inverness that is only sometimes on the map now.
and a lot of your work has to do with rural life. Would you...
I think so. I mean, at least some of it does. I feel sometimes, too, like I'm working on edges, the rural butted up against the city, and how that, you know, that margin is defined.
Mm-hmm. You have two or three books of poetry out.
Well, I have two out and one coming.
Oh, good.
Yes.
Good. So, Earl, we heard about this bear in the photograph, and I remember reading that. It's a great poem. Would you read that for us?
Yeah. That's called Bear Photo. This is there's a collection of photographs by the Doris Whithorn Collection, and they're public domain. So for just very, very little money, you can get prints of any of these photographs. So I have this photograph hanging in the house somewhere, and I looked at it for a long time, and then one day I just worked on this poem and wrote this. It's called Bear Photo. Taken in Livingston, Montana, sometime around 1900, this bear stands up perfectly straight on hind legs with his paws together up over his head, like maybe he's clapping, like maybe he's praying or pretending to pray. Really hamming it up. But I'd say probably praying directly to God. Yes, praying hard directly to God. It is a sunny day. The photo is grainy. The bear is shuffling about in the dirt street, dragging his 100-pound chain, squinting into the sun, acting quite naturally, totally clueless as to how a man might pray.
You know, when I read that, it reminded me of, I heard David Quammen talk about the National Geographic book that he did on Yellowstone Park, and talked about Yellowstone Park, and there was a time where you would actually sit outside in a sort of a half circle and watch bears come in to feed, and they would put garbage in the middle of this sort of arena so people could come and see these bears. And I remember watching it as a kid and seeing these bears stand up on their feet. And that was the most shocking thing I had ever seen, you know, that because they're so big and they're so human almost when they're standing up.
I remember that too in Yellowstone. I remember going through with my family and there was a bear that actually tried to climb in our car. And I remember a little girl with a Tootsie Pop. Her parents had, you know, she was probably seven. She had a Tootsie Pop, and she was teasing the bear with this.
That's always a good idea.
Yeah. Good bear etiquette.
Yeah.
I've heard a lot of fiction writers say that they started in poetry and then moved into fiction. I'm thinking of Shan Ray, who... I think thinks of himself sort of as a poet, but did a book of short stories and then just finished his novel. Do you have any aspirations to write fiction, either one of you?
Sure. I mean, I do. I have stories in my head, and at some point they may come out. I do write some nonfiction. And also, I think that, you know, all these genres have more in common than they have dividing them. And, you know, one phenomenon of our contemporary world is mixed genre. So people, you know, kind of even in a single piece of writing will move through several variations of genre.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that I think that's a great point, because I feel like I always am employing fiction or prose style in my poetry. On, you know, some poems more than others. I'll have characters with dialogue. I'm doing a lot of the things that you would be doing in fiction. I think that's a really good point, that the lines are very blurred. Another poet turned fiction writer who comes to mind is Dennis Johnson.
I first
read his poetry before I picked up any of the fiction, but I think In interviews now, he says he hasn't written poetry in a long, long time. But to answer the question, I do think about writing. I don't know if it would be a novel or a book of short stories, but I read a lot of fiction, and I really could see doing that, but I'm a little spooked by it, to be honest.
Both of you have interesting lives in addition to being poets and trying to get published. Earl, tell us about what you do.
I am a professional farrier, so I shoe horses for a living, and I've done that since 1998. Yeah, so I drive around two or three different counties with a pickup truck and hand tools and trim and shoe horses for a living.
You know what? I love that. It gives body to the poetry, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's real life stories. And Tammy, you have been a force for literature at MSU Billings for a long time, and I know that you teach there, but talk a little bit about some of the programs you're planning for this summer. I think those are really exciting.
Oh, yeah. Well, this last year, we proposed and established a branch of the National Writing Project here. It's called Elk River Writing Project. And it's a collaborative kind of arrangement with teachers, and it offers professional development for teachers. They're all writing-based, and so we have a writing program in June for K through 12 teachers. We have a program that we're running for the next 18 months, the College Ready Writing Program, where we do outreach to schools. We have one in July that is sponsored by the Memorial Library in New York, and it's focused on Holocaust studies and Indian education for all.
Wow.
Yeah.
In Montana.
Exciting.
Yeah,
and it's nearly full, actually. We may end up with a waiting list on that one. We have people coming from out of state for it.
Well, you know, that's so important. I know from the time that I was running the Writer's Voice, and we would send artists and writers out into the schools, the teachers were always so appreciative because poetry wasn't a part of what they were learning to become school teachers. And they really felt uncomfortable teaching it or even assigning it to students. So having a real poet in the classroom was really an impetus for me to start Poets on the Prairie program.
Yeah. Hmm.
Before we close, let's have both of you read one more poem from the book. And while you're looking for the poetry on your page, I want to tell people that this Wednesday at Big Sky Books, Lowell Yeager and several area poets will be reading from the anthology Poems Across the Big Sky. That's 5:30 on this coming Wednesday. Earl, you have a poem for us.
Okay, this is After a Terrifying Nap. Gratitude came down in the form of a golden grasshopper. Not golden like a bar of gold, an ingot, or golden like honey, or paint on a football helmet. It was another kind of gold. This grasshopper glanced in through the open window of a southbound car, hit the fleeced shoulder of a sleeping infant, and bounced down onto the floor. It came to rest beside a potato chip. The grasshopper sent forth a golden light. The infant awoke in his car seat, looked at the grasshopper, and wiggled his feet, his white socks. It is likely we are completely ignorant of our role in the universe.
And Tammy, what do you have for us?
Still Life with Nuthatch. A few feet away, a nuthatch pear walks the trunk of a poplar. One snoops under loose bark, then stuffs something in the other's mouth. Parent and bird child. The adult swoops to the maple, and the young one hesitates, easing itself up a branch before taking to awkward flight. When a flicker's large frame lands nearby, they move again to the poplar. All around, layered into the neighborhood, into the alley, is bird conversation. Watching the nuthatch from my porch chair, I remember having toddlers on a hot day, the pleasure of taking them to the pool, the simple hour or two splashing in sun and shade. The birds, now in a different tree, still feed and defy gravity. how often it fools me, the way the young seem large and capable until it's clear they have much to learn, and the adults so busy sometimes they forget their love of water.
I am glad to have had both the recent and the immediate past poet laureates of Montana, and I would encourage any listeners, if you would like to bring either Tammy or Earl to your school, to your community, contact Humanities Montana. It's a very inexpensive program, and it can bring to your community the great art and joy of poetry. Earl, Tammy, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Corby.
Yeah, thank you.
I've been celebrating National Poetry Month with a Poem a Day challenge. It's been quite difficult, actually, to write poetry daily, and I can't imagine doing it for much more than 30 days at a time. Artists Jason and Wendy Jam often challenge themselves to 100 days of creation. They discuss their process working together and independently, as well as committing to the time it takes to create original artwork on such a timeline. How did you two creative beings come together? You've been married for
21 years in May.
Wow. How do you balance this creative energy in your household? Or let's back up. How did you meet?
Wendy?
So it's funny because Jason and I met when we were both taking graphics classes out at the Career Center when we were in high school. Jason went to senior and I went to West, and we kind of ran with the same group and met for the first time out there, and then didn't really see each other again until I moved back to Billings in 1993, and I think we met up again around 95 and just kind of hit it off and took it from there.
21 years later, here we are.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about your household now. Being such creative people, how do you balance the need for, I'd imagine, autonomy and space to do your own individual projects while also coming together as artists?
Well, I have the basement and she has the upstairs.
Nice. So literally a separate space.
Yeah.
It helps that we're both a little bit introverted, so it seems pretty natural to kind of take that time to yourself and follow your creative endeavors during that time when you need to sort of stoke your fire by being alone with your craft.
But then you come together. You have a show coming up for the May Art Walk where, Jason, your cartoons, and Wendy, your craft, your dolls. You make dolls from Jason's cartoons. Am I explaining that right?
Well, close, but I usually make the dolls first, and then Jason takes it and does an illustration similar to like a children's storybook. And, you know, I always think the dolls are pretty cute when I finish them, and then once Jason comes up with his idea for the illustration, they just become even more endearing.
Tell me how you cartoon from a physical created object.
It's quite interesting, actually. Some of the dolls, when I take them downstairs, will seem to speak to me the role that they want to play. Some of them are much harder to find, and their scene will not come to me directly. It requires some searching. And by searching, it requires just spending the time in front of the blank piece of paper asking, what is your story? And then that story will be revealed, and it will be known because it is the one that makes me laugh or makes me excited inside. If it doesn't do that, then it's not their story.
Now, these aren't just your everyday dolls. Some of them are a little monstrous. Some of them are very sweet and endearing. Tell me how you go about putting them together.
So I have been a fiber crafter, so knitting, crochet, whatever, for probably, well, the last 21 years, since Jason's mom's the one who taught me how to knit. And probably about 15 years ago, I saw these amazing dolls that this artist named Beth Doherty was making. And they were crochet, and they were called amigurumi, which is the Japanese word for, I think, just small things. They're amazing, and so I honestly learned how to crochet just so I could make them. And it just sort of, I just kind of start at the top of the head and get going. Like, I'll pick some colors that I want to work with. And in the same way that Jason comes up with what the doll is meant to be doing in the illustration, like, it just sort of materializes as I'm working. Like, you'll start from the head down and say, oh, this guy's going to have, you know, one eye or five eyes or, you know, three arms, and they just sort of take shape as you progress from the head down and take on their own personality. And I started out making them for my kids and then every kid in the neighborhood. And then one time Jason just kind of did a doodle of one, and we thought, wow, that's really kind of cool to have a personality for this doll aside from, you know, the actual creation. And then we had the idea, I think 3 years ago we did the first collaboration where we did a...
Probably 4 years ago.
Yeah.
And that was when you were showing above the old Carlin.
Yeah.
You had a space that you guys would come together.
Yeah. In the gallery that I just recently vacated, we were coming up with ideas for shows for art walks. And we thought, hey, it would be a lot of fun if we did a combo show. And we wanted to show Wendy's dolls and the illustrations that went along with them. And so that's where it started. And it was incredibly popular with the people that came to the gallery. And so after that, we said, well, people really enjoyed this, so
yeah,
let's give them more.
To see them three-dimensionally, I remember first sort of walking into that space and getting to see, you know, a sort of flat cartoon with so much personality, but then you have this dimensional doll that goes along with it. It was a really fun idea to collaborate.
Yeah.
And playful, too. It seems like you mentioned this comes from making dolls for your children. And Jason, I think a lot of your cartoons have this childhood daydream-esque nature mm-hmm. to it. How would you describe your work? Is it as playful as it comes across?
Yes, it is as playful as it comes across. But like many of the things that I enjoyed, such as Warner Brothers cartoons and lots of things like that, it's geared towards two audiences. The younger audience who can enjoy what they're shown, and then the older audience who can enjoy a little bit more of the finer points, I guess you would say.
Yeah, yeah, a lot of the illustrations have kind of a deeper theme going on where, you know, the main character is feeling some kind of isolation or, you know, being poked fun at for something about them. And so you kind of see this whole, I mean, we've all been involved in that as we grew up, you know, this all these feelings that come about. And so to see it in an illustration where you can sense that feeling that you felt as a younger person, but then just the joy of the doll and the painting together, it's a pretty cool thing.
So tell us when these will be on display. If folks are in the Billings area, they can catch it at the May Art Walk?
Yeah, at the May Art Walk, May 5th, at the Yellowstone Art Museum.
So evolving out of your space, now you are showing at the YAM. That's a pretty exciting venue.
Yeah, it's I'm very excited to have my work shown there. That's been one of my goals ever since I started enjoying visiting the art walks. And then that was the whole goal of my gallery, starting my gallery, was to create my own audience. And so now I'm able to go to other galleries with my work.
And when do you do, outside of fiber art, I've seen some of the mandalas that you do. They're incredibly elaborate and ornate and so beautiful on all kinds of different mediums, too. I've seen them on stones, on paper. Tell me a bit more about that.
I got started doing the mandala artwork probably 3 or 4 years ago. And interestingly enough, we had been going through just some crazy changes in our lives as individuals, as a family. And it was kind of just a way for me to, I don't know, sit down and take my mind off of all the things that were going on with me. And I found that when I started to work on the mandalas that it was really calming and it was like a meditation. And so 2 years ago when Jason did his 100 drawings in 100 days, I did 100 mandalas in 100 days, which was interesting from the perspective of seeing, you know, the kind of commitment it takes to produce a piece of artwork every day for 100 days, and then to just be that engrossed in something that therapeutic. So I felt like at the time it was a really great thing for me. And then kind of from doing the paper ones, I branched off onto doing some art on rocks and stones. We vacation every year at Lake Ponderay, and it has like an entire rock beach. So I started doing it there, and since have just been drawing on stones all the time. And honestly, people find some really strong connections with rocks. And then once you put the mandala on them, you know, people just flock to those things like crazy.
It's the number one seller at the gallery, the painted rocks. Yep.
What a unique way to find meditation for yourself and also create something that helps bring in revenue.
Yeah.
Now, the 100 Days Challenge, Jason, you've been doing this for how many years?
Oh, since 2009 was the first year I did it.
And you've done it every year since?
I've done it every other year.
Every other year.
Because it is a huge challenge.
I'd imagine drawing anything on a daily basis for 100 days. Tell me about that. I'm in a poem a day challenge for 30 days, and I'm only on day 4, and I'm thinking, how the heck am I going to possibly create something original every day for a month?
Right. The 100 Days Challenge was started by, it was my own personal challenge that I created. And it was, I was feeling a bit lazy. And I thought, the only thing that I'm going to leave when I leave this world, you know, it has to be drawings. And so I have to draw. And so I thought, well, I'm going to do one a day for 100 days. I did it, and people enjoyed it. And so I thought the next year, 2011, I'd do it again.
Because you were sharing these socially as they came, correct?
Yeah, and so the first time I did them, I was just posting them on Facebook. And then the second time was on Facebook as well. And on my website, jamcomics.com, I would show them as well. In 2017, however, I had to pause because I thought I could handle that and creating the illustrations for this show, but I was not able to stay focused on one or the other. The way my brain works is if I'm on a project, I need to stay focused, because if I derail from that, then I will lose all my watercolor sensibilities because I'm in the pen and ink mode. I used to think that it would be that I wouldn't have any problem with that, but I find that if I'm in, say, an oil painting kind of mode, that I need to take some time and relearn all of my illustration skills. So it's really kind of fascinating.
Wendy, when you were in the mandala process for 100 days, you mentioned how meditative it was. Were you able to do anything else outside of that, or were you just really in that zen of that 100 days?
I think the important thing about the 100 days is just actually taking the time to do something. You know, you don't feel like sitting down and drawing another mandala after, you know, day 65. But once you sit down and you get started and you get into the routine of the process of laying it out and getting ready, then you just kind of settle in and do it. And I think that's a good lesson for anything. You know, during that time, I'm always knitting, always crocheting, always creating in that way. So it's pretty easy for me to switch back and forth between those because they're pretty different kind of modes of creativity. But it's pretty focused when you're doing something for 100 days. And I think just committing yourself to taking the time to sit down and do it is kind of the most important part, and the most important lesson that you get from it is that, you know, I don't have to have some great flash of creativity to make something. I just have to take time to sit down and start making something.
Yeah.
And see what comes out of it.
Definitely giving yourself permission to make bad art.
That was a lesson that I learned as an artist, was probably one of the most valuable, was I cannot determine what I think is good or bad, what I create. So that separated me from the creation, that then I was no longer a part of the creation. Once I put it out there, then it was somebody else's. It was the viewer's. And I was not allowed to say that's bad or that's good, because it wasn't up to me.
Thank you to Wendy and Jason Jam for the reflections on creativity and the collaborative process. You can see Jam Garumi at the Yellowstone Art Museum during the May 5th Art Walk in downtown Billings.
You've been listening to Resounds, Arts and Culture on the High Plains, produced by Anna Page, Corby Skinner, and Ken Siebert for Yellowstone Public Radio. Theme music by Alex Nauman. Hear this program anytime online at ypradio.org.